This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Test me. I kind of think that if you show me 100 stills from 100 different movies, I could tell you what genre of movie it was based on the look of it. Like, I think I'd get a B+ on this test. Some of that is costuming and set design, like we talked about with Stuart Blatt. But a lot of it is something called cinematography. Unfortunately, I don't know what cinematography is. I vaguely think it has something to do with cameras, but most of what I know about cinematography is from the documentary TV show Dawson's Creek. I'm picturing Dawson in a wheelchair with Joey pulling him so there's a smooth shot, one without the camera jostling. But Dawson was the director of his student films, so I don't know where the director ends and the cinematographer begins. In watching How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days so many times over the last 6 months, so many times, I have noticed some things that I think are related to cinematography. The way that Ben's office is lit is really different from the way that Andy's office is lit, for example. And I'm sure that those things work on me in ways that I can't understand. And I'm also pretty sure that cinematography is why I would get that B+ on my Stills of Movies genre quiz. Because someone spent a lot of time and a ton of know-how on creating a visual vibe for my viewing pleasure. And that's what we're going to talk to Chris Cagle about today, all the things that make up the way a film looks on screen. Chris Cagle is an associate professor of film history and theory in the Film and Media Arts Department at Temple University. I'm Vanessa Zoltan, and this is Hot and Bothered. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Okay, Chris, I'm going to start with, I don't know if this is going to be a hard or an easy question for you. What is cinematography?
It kind of means two things, really. I mean, If you take a film studies class, an intro to film 101 kind of class, they'll give you a whole chapter in a unit on cinematography, which really encompasses things like camera movement. How do you move the camera? What's its effect on screen? Framing? Do you frame it from the side, above, you know, looking down, looking from it below? And also shot distance. The closer you get to what you're shooting, there's also a kind of an emotional distance that can carry. It's not just one-to-one correlation, but, you know, shots that are further back have an effect on the viewer and on the meaning of the film versus shots that are up close, right? So that's the kind of standard, I think, 101. The thing is, most of those things are done by the director.
That's going to be my next question. So, yeah. Okay.
So people who work in cinematography versus directors of photography or the people who support that, the director of photography and the cinematographic staff, their job is really to light. They're responsible for putting enough lighting on the scene to capture the image in a certain way and to choose lenses and cameras, and in case of analog film stock, that will capture the image and to figure out the exposure, those kind of technical questions. But there's also creative and emotional parts of this too. How you light the scene can have an impact on what we see on screen.
Hmm. So sometimes you'll be like, ugh, Martin Scorsese, he works with that great cinematographer.
Right.
How do I know where Martin Scorsese ends and his amazing cinematographer begins?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're talking about the big choices about the camera moving or the framing of, you know, a close-up here versus a, you know, a medium shot there, those are really the director's choice. Some of it comes out through the editing too. Now, a cinematographer can have a say. You know, the cinematographer is the one who has to accomplish the camera movement. So whether it's a smooth camera movement or a jerky one, and there isn't always a firm dividing line. And I mentioned digital, like 1917, the World War One Sam Mendes film. It's all done in one take, but it really wasn't one take.
Of course.
They had to shoot it and sort of edit it together. So there had to be a collaboration between the director, the cinematographer, and the post-production editors to kind of create the cinematography.
Okay. Thank you. That was so helpful.
Okay.
What do I need to know in order to understand light design? How am I like, oh, this movie is really interestingly lit?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, just sometimes the terminology helps. There's a couple of things, one of which is the overall look. Is it kind of bright, which we call that high key? It's a kind of technical term for that. If every part of the image, you can see every nook and cranny of the set. So How to Lose Your Guy in 10 Days, everything's really well lit. Almost every single shot of that film is very well lit. There's no low-key lighting whatsoever in that film.
Mm-hmm.
Other films are much more atmospheric, and you see this a lot in like prestige TV, something like Chernobyl is a good example, where you have a lot of contrast between the darks and the shadows and the lit parts of the frame. We call that low-key lighting. So that's the kind of basic choice. Sometimes it varies by genre, by style. You know, with the rom-com, it tends to be a little bit more in that sort of high-key style. The other, I think, crucial term, which is really useful for a film like How to Lose a Guy in 2 Days, is the idea of three-point lighting. So if you just put a single light on somebody, sometimes that's the right choice. Like, you know, for instance, a news camera, you know, if they're shooting live coverage, they won't have a bunch of lights. They'll just have one light that's sort of right off to the side of the camera. It lets you see what you need to see. But it doesn't look very artful, right? It kind of washes out the person. It doesn't make the stars look glamorous. It doesn't have any really expressive possibilities other than that sort of signal as it being kind of on the fly footage, which could, you know, be important too. But most Hollywood films and even TV shows and Netflix shows have at least a balance of three lighting sources. The main one is from the front. It's called the key light. It's the brightest light. And that really gives the main illumination for the scene. But there's also a fill light, which is secondary to the key light. It's also from the front, but for the opposite angle. And what it does is kind of what's called modeling the face. It gives a sort of three-dimensionality to the person. And three-point lighting is a way to accentuate a person's features, both for beauty, but also for emotional expression. It could be anger, you know, or ugliness. So you can highlight different things with three-point lighting. And then the third light is sometimes ones that viewers don't necessarily notice at first. It's called the backlight or the kicker or the rim light. There are different names for it. But it's a light that comes from behind the person, often from above or below. You usually don't see the source of the kicker. But what it does is it makes the person stand out from the background. This is really important in black and white films, but even in color cinematography, cinematographers want to make the characters kind of pop out from everything that's going on around them. And that kicker light does that work, you know.
So you've already started answering this with high key light, but I'm wondering if you could tell us what other visual styles there are to a rom-com, right? Like there are stories of like directors putting Vaseline on the lens.
Yeah, we call that, cinematographers call that diffusion. So normally light can be very harsh and bright and direct. Often cinematographers will want to scatter that light. It's called diffusing it. And it gives a softer look. So it's not quite as harsh. And there are a couple ways you can diffuse light, one of which is you can put something over the lens, whether it's gauze or Vaseline. You could smear something over the lens or translucent glass, whatever. You could put something that will diffuse light coming into the camera. And that was often the heaviest kind of diffusion. It gives that sort of Elizabeth Taylor white diamonds kind of look, right? So, you know, but then you could also, and this is pretty common too, put diffusers on the lights themselves. So it scatters the light that's going onto the set. It kind of gives us a softer, less harsh look. And so there's a full continuum. Sometimes you have light, which is very harsh. Sometimes it's the full-on Vaseline in the lens. But most of the time, there's going to be a range. And you see it in this film, too. You see a good amount of range of diffusion in How to Lose a Guy.
If I just showed you a still of a rom-com, is there something about the visual style of the cinematography that you would be like, oh, of course this is a rom-com. It's like medium diffused and very well lit. And
that's a good question, because I was trying to watching the film, I was trying to think, well, what's typical? And there's some shots which are kind of typical in some ways. It's how they're done, but also what they show. There's like the view of New York, right? There's a certain ways in which New York gets shot in this telephoto lens. But I would say just in general, rom-coms have more diffusion than non-romance genres. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think all films have glamour cinematography, but rom-coms, I think, particularly trade in that. And one thing that's really noticeable here is how much glamour lighting is used on Matthew McConaughey, right? So, I mean, that's, I think, maybe one main difference is that the rom-com will give a kind of glamour treatment to the male star rather than simply reserve it for the female or the woman star, right? So,
what does the glamour treatment mean? How did you know that Matthew McConaughey had it?
He has a lot more diffusion, first of all. Uh-huh. Not as much as Kate Hudson, but, you know, there's certainly some diffusion on him. Uh-huh. And he gets more modeling than she does. She has almost this kind of porcelain doll treatment in terms of, you know, a little bit less modeling, as I would say. It kind of makes her face look a little flatter, but I think to kind of give it that sort of doll-like appearance. But with him, he has some modeling, but it's rounded out with extra fill, so it's not quite as harsh shadows from left to right. And it has more diffusion, so it definitely looks softer. You know, I don't know if I'm getting ahead of myself, but one thing which I think is a signature lighting style for this film, maybe even more than others, is just the amount of kicker. There's just so much kicker in this film. The cinematographer's always finding ways to make the backlighting have a sort of prominent role in giving that sort of glamorous illusion, but also sort of setting the scene. The lighting doesn't change too much from scene to scene, but the kicker color and the kicker quality does.
So I have a theory, and I'm just wondering if this is what you're talking about, that Kate Hudson is like always lit like she kind of has a halo in this movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's also in her hair design. Like she has these like wisps of hair that give her this angelic effect. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, the kicker is what does it. I mean, this is fancy true for blonde hair, but it works for other skin types, other hair types. But, you know, this is kind of caught up in sort of Hollywood's way of shooting blonde actresses. But anytime you put a bright light from behind on the blonde hair, it just makes it like glow, you know. And so it has that halo effect, definitely. So that's one clear sign that you have a strong kicker. It's just like that glow, that the halo effect you're seeing. Sometimes on Matthew McConaughey, he'll actually be on like the side shoulder or the side of his arm.
Yeah, show you how svelte he is.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's a way of kind of modeling his body, right? But it's also, again, a way of adding a kind of romantic tone to it, because often the light will be a different color. So that's one thing to look for in this film, is just whenever you see different colored lights, they might be pink, they might be blue. Everything else is kind of, in some ways, very normal. Like, the lighting is not meant to be noticed. I think I've read an interview with the cinematographer, you know, talking about how he goes for nuance. He doesn't want flashy stylistic effects. He doesn't want you to notice the cinematography. And I think that's true here. I don't think it's a film you think, oh, this is really great cinematography, even though it's quite accomplished. You know, it's not that kind of film. But, you know, I think the subtlety comes out in how it adds these touches. Like I say, the sort of colored lights that change from scene to scene or over the course of the scene.
So your comment about blonde actors just makes me think of an interview that I read with Issa Rae, that when Issa Rae was working on Insecure, that she had to work with a cinematographer that essentially had to like invent new lighting styles because there were so many people with darker skin than Hollywood is used to lighting. Is there a racial component to cinematography, and how should we think about that?
Absolutely. There's a film scholar, Richard Dyer, who I think has done some foundational work in this and talking about what he calls lighting for whiteness, how not only the practices of Hollywood, but the actual technology, particularly 35 millimeter was, and celluloid was, and lighting was crafted toward capturing white skin ideally. And it means that even people who are trying to do something different felt a kind of technological constraint of the medium. Mm-hmm. The ideology was baked into the medium, right? Yeah. So that even people, you know, shooting in non-European, non-US contexts had to kind of deal with this, what Kodak could do or what Agfa film could do, right? Right. Things have changed with digital. I think digital has less of that constraint built in, right? The digital has a much wider variation of what it can capture, how it can capture, how you can take out tonal parts of the image and really work with it, right? So I think it's opened up some of those constraints, but the practices have to catch up too. You know, cinematographers have to get accustomed to and even prioritize what it means to light skin by people who are not white. And I think some cinematographers are known for doing this, and But it's certainly, I think, in the field, it's definitely something that's part of the concern and discussion.
Yeah. It's just like such an interesting way to think about racism, how it's literally baked into technology.
Yeah.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm wondering if you can just tell me a little bit about, like, the studio history of cinematography. I have no idea. I'm just going to make something up. So, like, did Warner Brothers really invest in a certain kind of camera, and then MGM invested in another, but they invested more? I have no idea.
They did, yeah. Certainly, there were kind of industry-wide developments in cinematography during the studio period. But there was a house style at each studio and sometimes different technology, particularly for things like dollies, so the equipment that moves the camera around back and forth or side to side. 20th Century Fox invented what was called a crab dolly, where it could just sort of move around in circles a lot more easily, and their films use it. Whereas MGM had, they had the rotambulator, which could like raise it up and down while it was moving forward. So you see these things sometimes in the films.
I love this because, like, if depending on which dolly you have, you're like, well, we can make more musicals with women swimming because we have a dolly that rotates. Like, it literally impacts the art that's gotten made.
And I'm sure the technology was developed in part because of the genre specialization.
Right.
MGM had these, you know, spectacular musicals that they wanted to, equipment to shoot for. And it's kind of a problem solving. Like, the cinematographers and technical crew invented the equipment in some ways to solve the problems.
Oh, my God. Why are we putting tax dollars towards NASA? We should be putting it toward movies.
Well, I guess you could say that Hollywood has had lots of money to develop these things over the year. It's not exactly a poor cause. But.
Everyone donate your money immediately to the major film studios.
Yes.
They're doing God's work. So, How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days. I love that you called the cinematography, I'm paraphrasing what you said, but like invisible, but skilled. Right?
Right, yeah.
So, like, Andy's office, I don't know anything about anything, but, like, Andy's office seems very differently lit to me than Ben's office. Is that just, like, set design, or is that cinematography? Is that, like, a paint choice, and so it seems darker to me, or is that, yeah?
I think it's both. I mean, I think there's a bit more of a sense of lighting directionality. I mean, one thing that Bailey likes to play with is you have overall lighting for the scene, this high-key lighting where the light seems to come from nowhere and yet everywhere at the same time. But then he also sometimes likes to have what we call sort of narrative source for the light. Like, okay, the light's from the window, it's coming on the side. So it's his style is kind of balancing those two goals.
Mm-hmm.
Some of this is in the set, right? The Andy's office, it has all these kind of like midtown windows, whereas it seems that Benjamin's office has a kind of like slats on the blinds, you know, but it has a sense of directionality of the light. There's a bit more directionality in his office. And I think it gives that almost a kind of neo-noir look. I mean, it's not like that dark, but it, you know, also, I mean, think about McConaughey's breakthrough role in A Time to Kill, right? You have these like kind of harkening back to the iconography of the star, and that office kind of reminds me a little bit of that office.
Yes, I hadn't thought of that, but like where he and Sandra Bullock are doing all that work.
Yes, yes.
I love what you're saying about there being a narrative reason for the lighting, right? Like you're watching Ben light candles and then blow them out and like having to think about what that's going to do to the light. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Can I talk about one of my favorite scenes in the film?
Please?
Because I feel like a lot of the lighting is not that noticeable, right?
Right.
But to me, the one of the things I'm talking about is early on, you know, after their, it's not even their date, right? They first meet, they go back to his place. You know, she does the seductive thing in his room and like falls back on the bed. And there are two different lighting schemes. Like one, she's getting this like purple light from the bedroom window coming from outside. And he's getting a kind of like artificial incandescent light, like a little yellowy kind of light. Mm-hmm. And they're in two different worlds, right? The lighting is in two different worlds. They're in the same room. They're like feet apart. But the lighting is not only in two different worlds. It's suggesting two different genres. It's the genre in her head versus the genre in his head. And they're each playing the other, what they think the other one wants. You know, she thinks he wants the seductress and he thinks she wants the kind of romantic, and the lighting communicates all that pretty economically. You don't even necessarily know it, but she has this kind of purplish blue, almost low key. You don't really see the front of her very well lit. She doesn't have any fill light at that point. It just kind of makes all of her blonde hair purple, right? And then he has like, you know, the blue on one side, that sort of orangey incandescent on the other, kind of modeling him in this, like I say, this sort of glamour lighting, very romantic style of lighting. And they're narratively motivated. You know, she's by the window, he's not. And, you know, so there's like a kind of technical reason why this would happen, but that's not the real reason, right? The real reason is to communicate story and character psychology in that moment.
Yeah. I think that is what I'm learning about this movie. The more I watch it, the more troubling I find so much of its messaging. However, the economy with which it efficiently, like, she's all in white, he's all in black, they are lit in different ways in the same scene. The flowers on one character's wall versus the poker table color of another, right? Like, I'm just like, God, this movie is so tightly and efficiently and effectively made. It's just really impressive.
And I think, you know, one thing I think of as a viewer of rom-coms, but also someone who teaches film, is how do you know when characters have a revelation, right? You know, and this is tricky because they both have to, but particularly, you know, her character has to undergo some, she has to fall in love and realize she's falling in love and have some kind of moral qualms about her ruse, right? You know, and I think the smart thing is that it's not spelled out in dialogue, right? But it makes it challenging. How do you communicate these very like profound internal shifts in 10 days or even one day, really? Like, how can someone have this massive emotional shift in one day, not talk about it, and yet the movie capture it? And there's some directorial ways it happens, but I think, you know, for me, a lot of this happens in the lighting. The scene in the bathroom, you know, I guess they have sex, it's sort of implied, but in any case, they have this romantic, you know, moment in the bathroom, which is backlit. Again, he loves the backlighting, but the backlighting is the star here. Like, they, you know, that sort of codes as a kind of real moment for them, a real emotional moment, because the lighting has shifted. Mm-hmm. And later on, you know, when he's dropping her off afterward, they, you know, they take the ferry back and, you know, drop it off at her apartment. And the diffusion is super intense. And we get that full on romantic comedy, romantic movies diffusion there, which suggests he's undergone, you know, something, you know. And so I don't know if that's enough to convince every viewer. And I guess some viewers may be skeptical that this could happen that quickly. But nonetheless, like in terms of the movie logic, I think, you know, that's communicated through visual storytelling.
Yeah. I mean, and her hair gets curly. So, you know, she's not pretending anymore. She's really in love. Yeah. But it is so interesting how a movie works on you and you're like, oh, why did that work on me? And it is a million tiny clues that have like been set up for you. You know, we've talked a lot about the romantic elements of this film, but it's also been talked about, you know, intentionally as like a screwball comedy, that there are comedy genre like edits and ways that cameras are set up. I'm wondering if you can talk more about like setup, and I don't know why I feel like that is more to do with comedy.
Certainly the premise sets us up as a screwball comedy, you know, right. The double ruse, the journalism. I mean, it's a kind of like neo screwball comedy trope, right? Stylistically, I mean, I think there's a kind of simplicity to the film. It's not fussy in its direction. I mean, it feels more like rom-com direction than screwball comedy, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to be particularly energetic. It's like something like His Girl Friday, which is, you know, Howard Hawks is a very classical director. And the editing pace of the film and the way it's shot corresponds to the fast dialogue and some of it anchors that. Here, I was surprised how little the camera moves. Compared to other, like Jerry Maguire, like other films from the period where there's a sort of walk and talk following camera style that became the sort of hallmark of that sort of late 90s and 2000s Hollywood. There's not a lot of that here. The camera moves some, but not a whole lot. You know, usually it's slight reframings. So for instance, they're introducing characters, you know, at the editorial office of the magazine, the camera kind of follows each one as we get introduced. It's a very, I don't want to say this derogatorily, but it's a very pedestrian choice of when to move the camera. Mm-hmm. You know, the chase scene at the end, you know, we have this kind of great sort of shots following him. We have the helicopter shots, which again is a sort of staple of the rom-com, the pull up to show us, you know, from the characters to the New York City skyline. And again, those are flashy camera movements, but ones which are completely expected, right? You know, we almost a kind of iconography of the genre. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was trying to think, but I just did not see a whole lot of camera movement in this. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's some, but
I mean, when you have Kate Hudson's face, you don't need any fancy footwork. You've got a great face. Are there other things that we should be paying attention to just as we watch other rom-coms coming up?
I mean, I think one question I have as a director, like not me as a director, but as watching a director's work, is how much narrative agency does the camera have? And that's sort of a technical term, I guess, or a sort of jargony term, but does the camera have a voice in relationship to the action? In something like How to Lose a Guy, the camera, like I say, it has this invisible style. It often disappears in the action. If it moves, it's to follow a character, or the diamond banquet scene, right? Where camera's following people around, it moves. But we don't have a sense that the camera has a roving kind of presence in relation to the set or in relationship to the characters, right? Now, if you watch a lot of, say, prestige TV, you see a lot of camera which likes to assert its distance or its own independence from the action, right? And these are kind of two poles. You know, there's not just one thing fits all. So film will kind of go back and forth between the others. But I'm very curious, maybe one thing you're encountering in some of your discussions, I don't know, is, you know, the rom-com has fallen a little bit out of favor as a genre. You know, I know my students are not really into it as a genre. Or else they are. They feel like it's a guilty pleasure or, you know, mm-hmm. And that's fine. You know, I mean, I like rom-coms fine, you know, but it's not a genre which is prestigious at the moment. It's not a genre which gets funded as much as it used to.
Yeah.
So I'm very curious if the rom-com is going to take on some of this more prestige style. And, you know, maybe that's one way you could see that is in that sort of independence of the camera. And, you know, that has an implication for the gender politics. I mean, you mentioned you had some misgivings about the mixed messages. And I think romantic comedies are all about trying to reconcile opposites, right? You know, something like The Wedding Crashers, it's, okay, well, there's no such thing as permanent marriage. Oh, but yes, there is. We want to have both at the same time. And here, you know, we want to have the independent, smart, career-driven woman who's not going to throw everything down. But we also do want her to throw everything away for the guy. So it's like, you're right. So it's these reconciling the two opposites. And I think a smart director could find ways to achieve that by the camera movement and by the placement of the camera in relation to what we see.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I could just add one more thing, it was really remarkable to revisit this film because it is shot on 35 millimeter and on film. And it's a look which you don't see anymore. Yeah. I mean, even things that are shot on film look different than this film. It's a certain time and place, a certain use of color. I don't know if people are nostalgic about it or if they think it's passé. Either way, it's. I think it colors how we experience and feel this film.
Yeah. Chris, thank you so much. I'm so grateful. And I'm now an expert on cinematography. So.
Yes. I hope this is what you were looking for. So.
You were perfect. You're perfect.
Okay, great.
My head is full with all of these new terms, and I'm really excited to look at another scene now that I am the world's leading expert on lighting design. And so let's get the wonderful Hannah Rehack on the phone and look closely at the famous couples therapy scene. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Vanessa.
Okay, so we just watched this scene where Ben and Andy go and see Katherine Hahn for couples therapy. Can you give us a brief recap?
Yes, I can. Okay, we go basically, I'm just going to say, we go right from him agreeing to couples therapy right into the scene. Love it. She knocks on the door. Catherine Hahn opens it in huge glasses, looking very professional therapist. It is kind of a punchline in and of itself for her to open the door and we see her. They sit down. Immediately, she says, how are you going to pay? Andy looks at Ben like, up to you. And he goes, okay, well, whatever, you know, whatever it costs, whatever I got to do, whatever I've got to do kind of thing. He pays her $300. Crucially, according to producer Ariana, $300 with inflation is $500. So let's all be reminded that we may say couples therapy for $300. How normal? $500 per session right off the bat.
Which is the amount of cash he just has in his wallet.
Well, he's a diamonds guy.
I was thinking this time, I was like, oh, he'll probably be able to submit this receipt for reimbursement, though.
Oh, God. So grim. Okay, so then it's a heightening scene. Basically, anything that Andy says, the therapist, Catherine Hahn, heightens by asking Ben to talk more about it. And that just happens kind of on rotation time and time again. So it's like, maybe he has trouble in bed. No, it's because he's gay. When did you start liking men? Like it goes from the suggestion of a problem to what would be a fundamentally large problem for the two of them. And that happens with, like, it suggested that he has an anger problem. He's a rageaholic. And then Catherine Hahn and Ben hold hands after he does some deep breathing exercises, and it becomes, oh, he's interested in other women and he's hitting on our shrink and how dare he. Then Ben gets upset that Andy called his mother. And then from there, the therapist, lovely Catherine Hahn, is like, maybe you should go to Staten Island. There's a turn. Andy looks at her friend and like, why did you just suggest that? Oh my God. And then we know that the next scene is them going to Staten Island.
There's also some great, like, double acting from both Catherine Hahn and Kate Hudson, where they're like making faces at each other when Ben's not looking. Mm-hmm. The only other thing I want to add is that Matthew McConaughey, Ben, we've just heard him be like, couples therapy. Let's go to couples therapy. And then, like, pretty early on, there's this joke where Catherine Hahn is like, how long have you guys been dating? And Andy goes, 7 days. And she goes, oh, 7 days. Interesting. Because that's like, and he goes, a week. It's a week. Is this too soon for couples therapy?
Because it's not a lifetime. No, it's not a lifetime. It's a week.
It's a week.
Yeah.
To me, it's actually really good character development that he like got amped up the night before by his friends and being like, you got to do whatever you got to do to make this relationship work. And he like slept on it and is like, this is weird. We've been dating a week and I'm now in couples therapy.
Yeah. It makes me like angry for all the times that I've been in a romantic dynamic like that, where somebody agrees to something. And then when you actually get to do it, they're like, maybe not. And you're like, oh, you just did that to placate me. I'm just back to our earlier conversation of the heteronormative impulse of men to placate the women in their lives, thinking there won't be follow through. And there was. You got to do couples therapy.
Hand over the $300.
Yeah. 500 with inflation. Yeah. I think the scene is like, it's so awful. I think it's like a perfect example of why I hated this movie as a kid and why I think it's like so unpleasant if you don't like cringe humor, because it's pretty impossible to watch without just being like, oh my God, this is so profoundly uncomfortable. And it is through the therapy of talking with you after every episode that I'm able to be like, okay, but what's happening is it's like really great comedic heightening in a perfect way. It's a perfect example of that. It is, like you said, there's sort of this like Shakespearean doubling that's happening, where like there's one dynamic that everyone's clued in on, and then there are many other little dynamics that we're seeing played out. The one between Andy and her friend, then like we know Andy has her own game that she's playing, the one that Ben's playing on his own. We as the audience get to be in on all of it. And I guess there is a great pleasure for some people on being in on all of those.
I do think it's aesthetically a really interesting scene. Andy and Ben are in these like very Southern outfits. Like, yes. He's in an all white suit, yeah. And she's in like pink with this like very pink lipstick and like kind of this Jackie Kennedy vibe outfit. Mm-hmm. I don't know, like backlit, you know, whatever, but it is very like bright and vibrant, and it feels like a very stylized scene. Like, it's like, hello, we are in hijinks land.
Well, okay, this is so exciting, Vanessa, because I had a moment where I was watching where I was like, this feels like, because I was thinking about the heightening, like this feels like a really strong improv scene. And when Kate Hudson puts tissues under her armpits, I was like, that is such like an inspired move. I genuinely thought it was improvised and unbeknownst to me, but Ariana, lovely producer, just said that it was an improvised move on her part, which is like genius. It's so, she goes, I sweat when I'm nervous, to physically embody how over the top this moment is and this scene is just like, to me, that's the funniest part of the 3-minute scene.
Yeah. You know, in the Vanity Fair oral history article, it's the scene that it feels like Matthew McConaughey understands and like diagrams the best. Mm. He's like, this is why the movie is smart. Comedically, there are two people in on something. There's one person on the outside of a thing. Yeah. And yeah, like the stakes being so clear and the relationships being so clear, it makes sense to me that within that container, you could improvise really well.
Totally.
Every character knows exactly what they're playing, even when they're playing two things.
Yeah. And just to be a real improv nerd for a second, but that is fundamentally what you need in a strong improv scene. You need to know who the people are, where they are, and what they want. And ideally, they're competing wants without creating conflict, but still creating tension. And so like, it's not that he wants to go and get water and she wants to stay in therapy. That would be two opposing desires that don't make for an interesting scene. They both want to be in that couple's therapy room, but for different reasons. And those different reasons are how you get this really interesting tension that still keeps you present in the scene. Yeah, it's a great example.
Yeah, it's unbearable to watch, but it's so smart.
Oh, I have to say, I was kind of surprised just because it's 2003. I thought it would be more homophobic in the way they talk about him maybe being gay. And it's obviously still used for comedy, which doesn't necessarily hold up that great. But it really, to me, it just doesn't really feel like they were trying to make a joke of the idea of him being gay versus just like, yeah, like the idea that he didn't want to sleep with her on the first night means that like he's not interested in women. And we know that it's an absurd claim. So it doesn't really feel like it's punching down to me, which I was just surprised and kind of delighted by because I remembered that anecdote and couldn't remember if it got like super offensive.
Yeah. And that's in part the way Matthew McConaughey plays it, right? He's like, I like women. That's just the way I was born.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay. Yeah.
Fair.
Congratulations, 2003. You weren't hateful. Really? You were awkward, but not hateful.
You were awkward, but not hateful.
Okay. Do you want to go take a nap? You seem tired.
Yeah. I have to rest after that. Do I get the rest of the day off?
Yes. Take the day.
Thank you.
The grueling work of podcasting about a rom-com. You've been listening to Hot and Bothered. We're a small show, so we need your support to run. If you can, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/hotandbotheredrompod. If you love the show, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We are a Not Sorry production. Our executive producer is me, Vanessa Zoltan. Our consulting producer is Russell Maith. We are edited and produced by Ariana Nettleman and distributed by Acast. We love our soulmate level patrons. There would be Vaseline on the lens whenever I would film any of you. Gretchen Sneegas, whose window we would hold a boombox outside of. Molly Reilly, who we would chase through an airport to declare our love to. Becky Boo, who we would wait for hours on the top of the Empire State Building for. Elizabeth Schweinsberg, whose heart we would play a game of one-on-one basketball for. Lauren Bayer O'Connell, who we would call up on stage to dance with us in front of the whole summer camp. And Claudia Hammerman, who we would give the whole door to float on, even if there was room for both of us. A huge thank you this week to Chris Cagle and to our wonderful team, Julia Argy, Nikki Zoltan, AJ Aramas, Hannah Rehack, Margaret H. Wilson, Courtney Brown, Natalie Folkerts, Fidius Reyes, and Stephanie Paulsell.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.